Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Tomorrow you'll be worlds away.
Who was that girl?
Cosette.
And yet with you my world has started.
But he never saw me
Les Miserables is coming Christmas Day to a movie theater near you. Joining me in the studio to discuss Les Mis and a few other holiday movies is Dana Stevens, film critic at Slate, and co-host of their Culture Gabfest podcast, which we also air here on WNYC on the weekends. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Brian. Good to be here.
And you have not seen Les Mis, but there's a lot of buzz. What are you expecting?
Yeah, I'm going to see Les Mis today or tomorrow and write on it for next week. And I'm excited, curious, eager. People are deeply divided on it. And the thing that's interesting about it is this technique that Tom Hooper, the director, is using with the singing, right? Where instead of singing, dubbing in their singing later or having it dubbed in by other people, everybody is doing their own singing live and on site during the taping, which I suppose is supposed to give it the rawness of a theatrical performance. But of course, also lets the possibility of a lot of off-key bad singing come through, especially since a lot of these actors are not by career singers.
And this is, it's like when the great book gets turned into a movie, when a play like this gets turned into a movie that's so well known as a play.
It's always dicey turning theater into a movie. Yeah. I mean, there's that fear that it's going to look theatrical and claustrophobic.
And of course, it was a book first too, but it is so lodged in America's consciousness as a play.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see how it comes off. It's not really my kind of music, but I do like a lot of these performers, and some of them I'm actually very excited to see sing, like Anne Hathaway, who apparently gives a really devastating performance.
Peter Jackson's The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. It's set a December opening weekend record, and that's a big thing for a Christmas season. This one sounds a little like Lord of the Rings Part 4, but actually it's sort of a prequel for those of you who know the Tolkien books. Here's a clip.
My dear Frodo, you asked me once if I had told you everything there was to know about my adventures. Well, I can honestly say I have told you the truth. I may not have told you all of it.
Bilbo Baggins, I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
So Bilbo Baggins sets off on his journey. This is my Christmas Day plan, I will reveal. I will be at a Christmas afternoon showing of The Hobbit. But you're going to sit here and tell me now that it's not worth 3 hours of my time, right?
Lord help you, Brian. That's going to be a long Christmas afternoon. Just to have a hearty cup of eggnog before you go in, because it is a long sit, The Hobbit. It's nearly 3 hours long. It's 10 minutes short of being 3 hours long. And, I mean, you can sort of think of it. You said, is it part four of Lord of the Rings? It's sort of part 4A of Lord of the Rings, because it's only one of three parts of The Hobbit. Jackson decided to divide this relatively slim book into three separate movies. And I don't know if that was a financial decision or really just because he is so obsessed with that Hobbit universe. But even as a fan of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, I was just not able to bring it to The Hobbit. Oh, I do have a piece of advice for you for Christmas Day.
Yes.
Don't see it in 48 FPS, the new exciting frame rate. I don't know what to call it, the new technology that Jackson has developed.
Well, that was the next thing I was going to ask you about, because this is controversial. I know some people who can't wait to see it in 48 frames per second. And I know some people who are saying, I do not want to sit in a movie theater with that rate of things going by me. So what's the controversy here?
Well, you know, actually, if you're interested in the technology as technology, you might want to see it just to see what you think about that technology. It's in addition to being in 3D, right? Some of these screenings are shown at a frame rate. That is, the number of frames you see per second is double what it would normally be. And what that comes out to on the screen, at least in the state the technology is in now, to me, was that it looked like you were watching a BBC video or an amateur home movie sort of shot on the set of The Hobbit. It has this very crisp and highly resolved look, but at the same time, it looks kind of garish and overlit. And I found it really, really unpleasant. But it does have its champions.
I don't know anything about this technology, but why wouldn't more frames per second make something just clearer, like more pixels?
Right. Well, I guess you could say that it does make it clearer. It brings in more visual information, but maybe it's that changes the way that it has to be lit. I'm not sure what gives it that sense. You certainly do feel like you're sort of in a different visual space than you're used to being in the movies. So if you, for the sheer novelty of it, it might be worthwhile. But to me, it really, really kept me from getting into the story, especially because we're used to seeing Hobbit land and the Shire and all these places, these beautiful New England landscapes shot in this kind of burnished golden light, not sort of looking like a fake overlit studio.
So just go back to something retro and old-fashioned like IMAX 3D. Okay, so here's a clip from the trailer for Zero Dark Thirty, the much-anticipated film about the search for Osama bin Laden. And in this clip, we hear CIA agent Maya, played by Jessica Chastain, seeming to assert that she knows bin Laden's location with 100% certainty.
There's a 60% probability he's there.
I'd say it's a soft 60, sir.
It's 100%.
I know certainty freaks you guys out, but it's 100.
That's an interesting moment, and the music makes it chilling. But Joe Biden stated that in actuality, they were not 100% sure bin Laden was there. Is the film taking liberties with this, you know, very dramatic real-life story?
This is a big question that I guess nobody really knows except Mark Bowl, the screenwriter, who did some original research for the screenplay, which was another thing that was controversial, that he was able to get some sit-downs with CIA agents who knew the story that journalists were not able to get. And so he's either breaking news in some of the ways that he frames the hunt for Osama bin Laden, or he's making up news or funneling made-up news that has been given to him. And that, of course, is what's created the big controversy about this movie. I mean, I think obviously, you have to see the movie before you can weigh in on it. But it's important, I think, going in to know that it's not a rah-rah. This is not a rah-rah, go America kind of movie. I mean, there are moments of triumph, certainly. There are moments of incredible suspense. But it doesn't feel like a war movie where we're rooting for the bad guy to get blown away. It feels like a morally complicated and painful movie in the same way that the war itself and the war on terror has been morally complicated and painful.
And yet the film has been accused of inaccurately suggesting that the use of torture led to information on bin Laden's whereabouts. John McCain, Dianne Feinstein, Carl Levin, so some Democrats as well as Republicans, have written to the CEO of Sony Pictures suggesting that the film should correct that impression that torture was an effective means.
Right. And then that, in turn, has become, you know, sort of a dividing line between the film critic view of the movie and defense of it and the kind of political writer and politician takedown of the movie. And I think that's kind of an artificial divide, because the fact is that the movie is unsettling. It's not as if just because you admire Catherine Bigelow's filmmaking, you come out feeling perfectly fine about the war on terror. It is ambiguous and it is upsetting.
And she, of course, had previously made The Hurt Locker, which a lot of people took as an anti-war movie that was very sympathetic to our troops.
Yeah, that's another movie where I think her portrait of the reality of the war sort of transcends either a good or bad judgment about it, right? It's just about what it is to be one of those bomb-diffusing warriors.
By the way, this is outside the realm of a film critic's beat, but I think Dick Cheney's position is still that torture did help them get information that helped them get bin Laden.
Right, yeah, and which is why, who was it that said this is a movie Dick Cheney will love? I think that was a Frank Rich line.
Right.
And the movie definitely leaves that as something that you can decide for yourself.
And it's not the only movie out based on harrowing real events. Argo comes to mind, another CIA secret operation thriller. There's also The Impossible, a true story about a family that survived the tsunami of 2004. Is this a trend?
I guess ripped from the headline is kind of always a trend, but it does seem like we're at a political moment where we want to have our tragedies processed into movies pretty soon after they happen. I mean, Zero Dark Thirty was really happening very tightly on top of the event, and they started to rewrite the movie after Osama was found and killed. So it's I guess it is a trend.
Okay, pick one more to talk about before we run out of time. Amour, Foreign Film Buzz, or Django Unchained? Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, if you had to choose between the two on Christmas Day?
No, just one you'd rather use your remaining time to comment on.
Oh, those are both tough movies. Amour is the better film of the two, I think. Michael Haneke's Amour is a masterpiece, one of the best films of the year, I think, but very, very hard to take. It's the story of an octogenarian couple essentially coming face-to-face with the death of the woman played by Emmanuel Riva and how they negotiate her last days. It's very hard to watch.
That's cheery.
But it is really extraordinary. And I wouldn't call it uplifting by any means, but nor is it nihilistically depressing. It's just gorgeous. Just Django Unchained is another whole story. Do we have time to talk about that?
Can you do a 10-second blurb?
Django Unchained, if you liked Inglourious Basterds, if you can take that kind of jokey violence that Quentin Tarantino does so artistically and so disturbingly, then you'll love Django Unchained. I found it queasy and yet dazzling.
And finally, The Sopranos creator David Chase has his first movie opening in limited release today. It's Not Fade Away. What did you think of this film, Dana Stevens?
Very unexpected first film from David Chase. Nothing like The Sopranos at all. It's sort of a gentle coming-of-age story about a rock band, a bunch of teenagers forming a rock band in the 60s. And it's co-made with Steven Van Zandt from The Sopranos, a friend of Chase's. We're seeing if you want to follow his career.
We're seeing if what we're seeing David Chase take an interesting career turn. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, completely unexpected as his first film.
All right. And we will leave it there. We're going to finish up with some music from Not Fade Away about the striving rock band in the 1960s New Jersey suburbs. So after a very heavy show today on guns and Sandy relief and all kinds of stuff, we thank Dana Stevens from
Send
Slate
in the Clowns
and the Culture Podcast for, well, you talked about movies that made us think, not just movies that made us laugh.
I
so thanks
so.
A lot.
Thank
and
you,
Merry Christmas. Happy holidies, everybody.
Same to you.
Have a great weekend. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.